book. They poisoned the world. Life and death and the age of forever chemicals. We'll speak with investigative journalist Mariah Blake. Stay with us.
Skin glows in the dark, shines in the light. It's the color that holds me tight. Brown, me is the shade that's just for me. I'm never not missing anything but me. Cause I love you and I can't miss anything but you. And you're stuck on me, and all this time I'm inside you. Stretch and we show as tough as it goes, and it won't rub off of you. As friends of similar shades.
It's My Brown Skin by El Lado Negro here in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in New Jersey have won what they say is the largest environmental settlement ever achieved by a single state when chemical giant DuPont and its affiliates agreed to pay $2 billion to clean up four industrial sites contaminated with forever chemicals, or PFAS, which are widely used in industrial and consumer products, even though they're linked to cancer and birth defects. It's the third PFAS-related settlement New Jersey has reached in less than 3 years. This is Maya Van Rossum of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, which is part of the litigation.
We have PFAS contamination of the fish that live in the Delaware River. It's so insidious. And, of course, PFAS, PFOA, various members of this man-made family of chemicals is literally in the bodies of people in New Jersey and nationwide, having devastating health consequences. I think that this case really is going to send a message loud and clear that's going to reverberate across the nation.
Studies show how PFAS contamination is now so ubiquitous that forever chemicals have been found in rainwater and the blood of almost all humans. This comes as the Trump administration has shuttered the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Research and Development, which helped test for PFAS. And we're going to talk about just what PFAS are with our next guest, Mariah Blake, investigative journalist and author of the new book, They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals. It's on Ralph Nader's list of books to read this summer. Her guest essay for the New York Times is headlined, This is How to Win an Environmental Fight. Meet the unlikely warriors on the front lines of a major environmental battle. In her book, Mariah Blake reveals how the U.S. government's top secret Manhattan Project that developed the atomic bomb that was dropped 80 years ago this week on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was also responsible for the development of PFAS. A lot to go through here. Mariah, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, start off by telling us what PFAS, P-F-A-S, are, and then talk about the victory in New Jersey, and then we'll talk about this historic week, 80th anniversary of the dropping of the bombs on Japan, and how that links to PFAS. Start with what they are.
Okay. So PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, are a large family of substances that have some pretty remarkable properties. They're extremely resistant to heat, stains, water, grease, electrical currents. They stand up to chemicals that are so corrosive they burn through most other materials. And this has made them extremely useful. So they helped usher in the era of space travel and high-speed computing. They've transformed thousands of everyday items, from cookware to dental floss to kitty litter. On the other hand, they are probably the most insidious pollutants in all of human history. So we are talking about a class of chemicals that do not break down in the environment. And in fact, they persist for hundreds, thousands, or even millions of years. Those that have been studied are highly toxic, even in the most minuscule doses, and they are literally polluting the entire planet, including human blood and ecosystems in the remotest parts of the world.
And Mariah, I just want to say that PFAS actually stands for per and polyfluoroalkyl substances. That's the PFAS. Keep going.
That is correct. That is correct. So, yeah, I think the clearest example of their ubiquity comes from the study you mentioned of rainwater around the world. So a group of prominent European scientists in 2022 looked at the levels of just the two best studied PFAS in rainwater around the world, and they found everywhere in the world, including the remotest regions, places like the Tibetan Plateau, the levels were high enough to endanger human health and the environment. So the levels were higher than the EPA's safety standards for those chemicals in drinking water. The same is true of breast milk in many countries. So not only are these chemicals ubiquitous, they're ubiquitous at levels that, you know, that are potentially harmful to our health.
Explain what happened this week in New Jersey.
So this week, New Jersey, which is really... New Jersey is where PFAS were initially invented and mass-produced. New Jersey settled with DuPont and other companies for $2 billion. This is in response to PFAS contamination. So the companies have agreed to pay $2 billion in compensation, and there's also a cleanup fund. And this is, as I understand it, the largest settlement paid to any state in the history of litigation.
And so let's go back in time. You know, just a few days ago, August 6th, you had the bells ring out as they do every year in Hiroshima, as they remember what happened this year. It's 80 years ago, August 6th, 1945. On Saturday, that's the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb. The U.S. dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Talk about what PFAS, what these forever chemicals have to do with the secret Manhattan Project that developed the atomic bomb.
So this is one of the things I found most surprising in my reporting. This class of chemicals that are now ubiquitous in the environment and consumer goods was actually developed by the U.S. government as part of the Manhattan Project. And the reason the government needed them is for uranium enrichment. So uranium enrichment involved a highly corrosive chemical called uranium hexafluoride, and almost nothing could contain it. And so they needed substances that could stand up to this chemical, and they determined that the only ones that could were ones that combined carbon and fluorine, which together form the strongest bond in chemistry, and that is what PFAS are. So they developed them during the Manhattan Project, and they were put into mass production during the Manhattan Project at a factory in New Jersey, a DuPont factory, in fact. And it was clear from the beginning that these were dangerous chemicals, so the plants where they were produced commonly had fires and explosions. Workers who worked in these plants were constantly being hospitalized with breathing problems and chemical burns. And in fact, Manhattan Project inspectors warned their supervisors that the fear of injury was causing unrest at these plants, and that people in other parts of the DuPont facility had come to fear an assignment to the fluorocarbon or PFAS production as an exile to Devil's Island. But it wasn't just workers who were affected. So around 1943, farmers downwind of this plant in New Jersey began to complain that their peach crops were burning up, that their cows were so crippled they couldn't stand. They had to graze by crawling on their bellies. And in some cases, farmers were also falling ill after eating the produce that they picked. Now, the farmers' complaints really alarmed Manhattan Project officials. They worried that the farmers would sue and that it would compromise the secrecy of the Manhattan Project, but also that it would open the government and its contractors up to liability. So in 1943, they launched the secret medical research program that researched the health effects of various Manhattan Project special materials, including uranium and plutonium. In fact, as part of this program, Manhattan Project scientists injected unknowing cancer patients with plutonium. But they also researched the health and environmental effects of PFAS. And Manhattan Project scientists had determined as early as 1947 that these chemicals were highly toxic and that they were accumulating in human blood. So one of the things that makes these chemicals so harmful is that they build up in human blood and they stay there for a long time. Now, this program continued after the war under the auspices of the Atomic Energy Commission, and by 1970, scientists within this program had determined that PFAS were accumulating in the blood of people all over this country.
So if you can talk about, because, I mean, this book exposes so much, the title of your book is They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals. Can you talk about who they are, talk about the role of the U.S. government, and also the corporate cover-up of known dangers? One of your points is that you show how DuPont established the principle, all new chemicals are safe until proven otherwise. Mariah.
So after the war, a company called 3M acquired a license for technology to produce PFAS, and it hired Manhattan Project chemists to develop them for use in commercial production and, you know, for manufacturing purposes and also for use in consumer goods. So one of the first PFAS-based products was Scotchgard, the fabric protector, which is ubiquitous. Yeah, so and then DuPont also began producing them, and these two companies also began studying the health effects very early on. So as early as 1960, they knew these chemicals were toxic. As early as 1970, they knew they were accumulating in the blood of people all over the United States. They subsequently examined thousands of blood samples from people all over the world, including remote rural China. The only samples they could find that didn't contain these chemicals were collected from Korean War vets before 1952. So decades ago, these companies knew that these chemicals were ubiquitous in human blood. Now, the findings about their presence in human blood alarmed insiders in DuPont and 3M, and they began intensively studying the health effects of these chemicals. They quickly discovered, they discovered that they didn't break down in the environment, and that is one of the things that makes these chemicals uniquely harmful. But they also discovered that they had a devastating effect on lab animals. So in one case, 3M tested these chemicals on monkeys, which were chosen because they're more biologically similar to humans than lab rats. The study had to be aborted because all of the monkeys died. When they started examining the effects on their workers, they found, you know, similarly alarming findings. So they, as early as the 1970s and 80s, they were linking these chemicals to leukemia, kidney cancer, immune suppression, organ damage, dramatic drops in testosterone. Even more alarming, they had begun to connect these chemicals to birth defects. So in the 1970s, 3M conducted a study that found that a certain PFAS caused birth defects in the eyes of rats who were exposed in utero. And DuPont decided that it would start to monitor the pregnancies of workers in its Teflon factories. Teflon is made with PFAS. To see if their children also developed birth defects. And in fact, two of seven women who gave birth during the course of the program gave birth to children with facial deformities very similar to those found in rats. But rather than inform workers or regulators or the public, DuPont simply canceled the study and continued exposing workers to these chemicals. And continued releasing these chemicals into the environment, even though there were very simple steps the company could have taken to filter them out of, you know, the air and wastewater that was coming out of their plants.
Finally, you wrote a piece in the New York Times. This is how to win an environmental fight. Meet the unlikely warriors on the front lines of a major environmental battle. In this last minute we have left, who are these warriors?
So there's an unlikely network of activists all over this country, farmers, factory workers, suburban moms, whose lives have been personally affected by PFAS contamination. And they have been aggressively lobbying for action, and they have been remarkably effective. So largely as a result of their activism, hundreds of laws restricting these chemicals have either passed state legislatures or are pending in state legislatures. And many of these laws not only, they ban the entire class of chemicals in consumer products. So this is revolutionary because traditionally the way we regulate chemicals in this country is one by one. But these state level laws are banning the entire class of chemicals. We also have a tsunami of litigation driven largely by individuals. And the combination of these two factors, the state-level legislation, there's a ban in the works in the EU as well, and this huge volume of litigation against PFAS manufacturers is prompting large swaths of the economy to voluntarily move away from PFAS. So 3M, the world's largest manufacturer of these chemicals, has announced that it will quit producing them by the end of this year. And dozens of major retail chains like Apple, McDonald's, Amazon, Target have done the same. So they have announced that they will reduce or eliminate PFAS in their products and packaging. So there is a hopeful dimension to the story.
Mariah Blake, I want to thank you so much for being with us and for writing this book. Mariah Blake is author of They Poisoned the World, Life and Death in the Age of Forever Chemicals. Coming up, we speak with a survivor of Jeffrey Epstein. Where are the survivors when it comes to the whole debate around the release of the Epstein files? We'll talk to Jess Michaels back in 20 seconds.
So.
Women of the World by the late blind singing duo Amadou and Mariam in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at attempts by the Trump administration to quell an uproar by Trump's MAGA base over the government's refusal to release files related to the dead serial sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein. CNN's reporting, Vice President J.D. Vance met with top Justice Department officials Wednesday to discuss the Epstein case. The meeting was reportedly set to take place at his Washington, D.C. home, but was moved to the White House amidst intense media coverage. The gathering reportedly included Attorney General Pam Bondi, FBI Director Kash Patel, among others, of course, with J.D. Vance, who discussed the need to craft a unified response to the Epstein scandal and emerging details of Trump's longstanding friendship with the dead serial sex trafficker. CNN's reporting directly contradicts Vance's denial that officials huddled behind closed doors for this discussion. Meanwhile, the family of Jeffrey Epstein survivor Virginia Giuffre has called on President Trump not to consider clemency for the serial sex trafficker's co-conspirator, the convicted sex felon Ghislaine Maxwell. She was the first Giuffre was the first survivor to come out publicly against Epstein. She died in Australia in April, reportedly by suicide. In a statement, Giuffre's family members said they were alarmed by these comments of Donald Trump in July when Trump said Epstein stole Giuffre away from his Mar-a-Lago club, and that was the reason that he threw Epstein out.
I think she worked at the spa. I think so. I think that was one of the people. Yeah. He stole her. And by the way, she had no complaints about us, as you know, none whatsoever.
In response, Giuffre's siblings and their spouses wrote, quote, it was shocking to hear President Trump invoke our sister and say he was aware that Virginia had been stolen from Mar-a-Lago. It makes us ask if he was aware of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell's criminal actions, especially given his statement 2 years later that his good friend Jeffrey likes women on the younger side, no doubt about it, unquote. We in the public are asking for answers. Survivors deserve this, the family of Virginia Giuffre wrote. Well, Ghislaine Maxwell was moved from Florida to a minimum security prison camp in Texas just days after she met with Deputy U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche, who formerly served as Trump's personal criminal defense attorney. Maxwell serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse and traffic underage girls. Trump has not ruled out pardoning Maxwell. For more, we go to Jess Michaels, a survivor of a 1991 sexual assault by Jeffrey Epstein. She's an advocate for sexual assault survivors, the founder and CEO of Three Joannes, a public benefit corporation. Jess, thanks so much for joining us. I think the key question right now, as we hear about these private huddles, we know about Todd Blanche getting the nine-hour response of Ghislaine Maxwell, who is a convicted perjurer as well. Is he also speaking to survivors? This very serious question of where voices like yours are. Can you talk about what this all has meant for the survivors? It's believed the survivors of Maxwell and Epstein might number as much as 1,000, you included.
Well, firstly, Amy, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for asking for the survivors' perspective on what's happening, because you are, and this White House is not. When you ask me how we feel about that meeting that they had about the Epstein situation, in quotes, what it didn't include was any survivor voices, any victim voices. And that's something that is very frustrating for all of us to hear. I also had heard you mention earlier, you know, where are survivors in this? And I want to point out, the victims of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell have been speaking up for almost 2 decades. That's 2 decades, including the 2006 case against him. But before that, authorities were alerted in 1996, by Maria Farmer, who's now leading a class action suit against the government, the FBI, and I believe it's the Florida Attorney General's office for not following protocols for being alerted of sex trafficking. So victims have been doing the right thing. Where it's fallen apart is any accountability and justice. And that's really frustrating. What's incredibly beautiful about this moment is that this issue is crossing party lines. There is no one out there that is okay with child sex trafficking.
As you point out, Maria and her sister, Annie Farmer. Annie Farmer testified at Ghislaine yes. Maxwell's trial. And what yes. is also amazing here is that she has been moved after speaking to Todd Blanche, Trump's former attorney, criminal defense attorney, to a from Florida to a Texas minimum security prison camp. I don't know yeah. if any sex felon has ever been at a minimum security prison camp. Because, again, important to point out, and you've worked with so many of these survivors, she's not only accused with conspiring to bring women and girls to Epstein, but she herself abused women.
Yes. Yes. She participated. And so when I hear a call for her to be considered a victim of this, I am appalled. I'm sick to my stomach that anyone would say a grown woman molesting children is a victim in any way. And we could go on. That's a whole other interview and discussion, Amy, on what is a victim. But it is appalling that there is so little justice for this issue. So on one hand, we have this wonderful public support of finally believing that survivors of Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell have been harmed. And they're behind. America is behind the victims, 100%. That's what I'm seeing in my comments. That's what I'm seeing on social media. That's what I'm getting in emails and DMs in an overwhelming degree. And the reason they're responding this way is because they are seeing now, maybe for the first time, the horrific lack of justice for sexual assault survivors when there is so much evidence. Because it's not just all of the videotapes and the audio tapes. It is victim impact statements. All of our victim impact statements are in those files. And we are all saying the same thing. Release them. Protect our identities, but release them. Release them now. And guess who else doesn't want those files released? Ghislaine Maxwell does not want those files released.
Why?
Because it's going to prove how much she was involved. There are victim statements about her.
And what do you make of President Trump refusing to rule out a pardon? You almost have the sense of moving to a minimum security prison camp, then possibly what? House arrest, and then a pardon. Each one is a trial balloon to see how the public responds. But what's so interesting about this is that MAGA has divided over this, President Trump's base.
Yes, yes. Do you know what I find really fascinating about this whole thing is the miscalculation on his part? I have been speaking up as an advocate for 4 years. And in my comments 4 years ago, when I shared that I was an Epstein survivor, I would see right-leaning, up to MAGA, serious MAGA saying, you know what, Donald Trump is on top of this. Donald Trump is the one that's helping the FBI get the evidence on him. They really believed that he was law and order. And I think that's the big disconnect right now, is they're finding out that he's not following through with who they thought he was, and it's really backfiring. I think it's also backfiring for him because I'm not the 22-year-old girl that was raped in 1991. The children that were abused by Maxwell and Epstein are no longer children. We are women. And I think he is greatly misunderstanding the strength and resolve of women that have been systemically and over time completely ignored. You never hear the words Epstein victim or Epstein survivor out of this White House. I have yet to hear those two words. It's always about, we are going to get the bad guys. Here's the first big phase one dump of information from Pam Bondi in February. But we never hear, we're going to get the victims justice. We care about how the victims feel right now. We're going to try to move this along in a way that gets the victims and those survivors that have been working so hard to speak up justice. That's not happening. So. It is a level of injury that is painful.
We just have 30 seconds, but I don't want to end before you talk about trauma, before you talk about PTSD, or as you call it, PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, of the survivors at this point.
What I think people assume is that we are just struggling emotionally. What happens for me, I'm speaking for me now, is that the pain is physical. It's fatigue, it's stomach aches, it's heart palpitations, it's headaches, it's insomnia, it's anxiety, it's an inability to just calm my nerves down. So it has physical repercussions that I think people are not aware of.
Jess Michaels, I want to thank you so much for speaking out. 1991 Epstein rape survivor. She was 22 at the time. Now she's head of an organization called Three Joannes. That does it for our program. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Hi, this is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them. Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.